This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So the hotter it gets, the faster it gets hotter. And the hotter it gets, the faster it gets hotter faster. Until you move into a process that is completely uncontrollable.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Radio EcoShock. We are just beginning to understand why the sudden meltback of the Arctic sea ice could change the climate of the world. If you live in the Northern Hemisphere, your own weather has already changed because of it. This may not be pleasing holiday fare, but our time together is limited and valuable. Critically important news, I can't let it go unreported, no matter what the local tragedy is that's dominating the mainstream headlines. As we will hear in this program, there is enough methane buried in the Arctic to drive us into an extinction event from runaway climate change. It could be beyond our ability to adapt. I'm going to talk at length with Paul Beckwith. He's trained in engineering and physics, but is now working on his PhD in climate science at the University of Ottawa. I also know Paul as part of a group of scientists and activists called the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, or AMEG. You can find my earlier interview with one of AMEG's senior scientists, Arctic ice expert specialist Dr. Peter Wadhams of Cambridge University. That's in the Radio EcoShock show February 15, 2012. I also interviewed critics of this theory that methane from melting permafrost and shallow northern seabeds poses an immediate emergency for the planet.
Oh my God! Breaking up!
I'm also going to present for the first time a radio adaptation from a new movie by the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. You will hear from Dr. Wadhams, but also from James Hansen, the NASA super scientist, plus Natalia Shakova, a Russian scientist now working at the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and from David Wasdale, founder of the Apollo Gaia Project. In my blog at ecoshock.info, you can find a link to my past Radio EcoShock interview with David Wasdale in our December 10, 2010 show called Beyond the Tipping Point. It's really worth a listen if you missed it. As you heard in our recent programs, the possibility of staying below the alleged safety point of 2 degrees Celsius temperature has more or less passed away. Reports from the World Bank, the International Energy Agency, accountants PricewaterhouseCoopers, the United Nations, and many more show that the world is headed to at least a 4-degree warming by 2100, if not sooner, unless space aliens come to save us or unless we finally wake up and take immediate action. The year 2012 has been the hottest in instrumental records, hotter than the previous tide records of 1998 and 2005. According to Joe Rome at thinkprogress.org, quote, the very warm November and early December assures record-breaking 2012, end quote. Weathermeister Jeff Masters from the Weather Underground writes, the year-to-date period of January to November has been by far the warmest such period on record for the contiguous U.S., a remarkable 1 degree Fahrenheit above the previous record, end quote. Not coincidentally, and despite all the expense of international climate conferences, world greenhouse gas emissions are not dropping, but rising steeply year on year. The Global Carbon Project, which measures such things, finds global emissions in 2012 set a new all-time record. That's very discouraging news. In 2012, we pumped out an eye-popping 58% more greenhouse gases than the world did in 1990. I'm going to play you a short clip from Corinne LeQuaire. She's a professor of climate change science and policy at the University of East Anglia in the UK, and she's the director of the prestigious British climate modelling agency, the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. This is a short audio from a film clip at the Tyndall Centre site.
Our latest study with the Global Carbon Project shows that the carbon emission from burning fossil fuel are set to increase again in 2012 to a record high of 35.7 billion tons of CO2. And it means that the global emissions now are 58% above the level they were in year 1990, the reference year for the International Kyoto Protocol. Contributors to global carbon emissions in 2011 were China with 28%, the United States with 16%, the European Union with 11%, and India with 7%. The 2012 rise in carbon emission further opens the gap between the real world emissions and those that are required to keep global climate change under 2 degrees, which is the international agreement. If the carbon emissions continue the way they are leading to climate change of 4 degrees and above. We, the scientific community, were often asked what a 4-degree world would look like, because after all, we have seasons and day and night, so 4 degree really sometimes doesn't really feel like very much. But actually, I think that we globally, we might be able to say with some confidence what 1, 2, and perhaps 3 degree looks like. But when you start looking at changes of 4, 5, and 6 degrees, is really out of bounds of anything that we've experienced in the recent past. And so these are really, really big changes in the way that the Earth operates. Nice. But we're talking about warming changes that that are really enormous in the climate system, and it's difficult to say what this is going to look like, what kind of vegetation transitions we will have, what kind of changes in the soils where we grow our food, ice and melt, what does that do for instance, the weather patterns and for the changes in extreme events. To be honest, such high climate change level are really so much outside the bounds of experience that it is very difficult to say what such a world would look like, and impossible to guarantee that it would be safe for a population of 7 billion people and more. I am worried about the continued increase in global carbon emissions and the consequences for climate change in society.
That was from the Tyndall Center, Corinne LeQuaire. Warming will impact the whole world, not just the Northern Hemisphere. Graham Redfern, a correspondent for ABC Broadcasting in Australia, tried to look at what that country could experience in a 4-degree hotter world. His article came out December 10th, 2012. Find a link to it in my blog at ecoshock.info or at my source, climatechangepsychology.blogspot.ca. For example, quote, in 2008, work by CSIRO found that if there was no action to cut global emissions, the number of days each year over 35 degrees centigrade experienced in Australia's capital cities would jump dramatically. For example, Darwin gets about 9 degrees a year over 35 degrees C, but by 2070, this was projected to rise to 221 days. More than half the year would be above 35 degrees centigrade. Melbourne would go from 9 days to 21 days above 35 degrees C, and Sydney from 3 to 9, end quote, from ABC Australia. There are similar projections for America. Most cities in the U.S., and especially in the South, would be sweltering through unbelievable heat waves, and that would be the new normal for summer. ABC Australia's Redfern continues, quote, Professor Jean Palukatoff, director of the government-funded National Climate Change Adaptation Research Facility, believes in Australia 4 degrees warmer than today will be a very different place. Quote, it would be just too unpleasant to be out of doors, she says. People would be living far more enclosed lives. It would be a heavily energy-dependent existence, as you have to cool off all those spaces where you put people into. You would have to be running your air conditioners as a matter of course. The huge challenge would be to lay our hands on the energy we would need to maintain our comfort levels. End quote from ABC Australia. And believe me, with peak oil and the dirtier and dirtier hard energy sources we're turning to already, I don't think we'd keep those air conditioners running. And never mind the disappearing coral reefs, all the ice and snow gone, forest burning and burning, and mass extinctions of animals, plants, and insects. We've just talked about 2012 setting a new record for greenhouse gas emissions. The Global Carbon Project measures only emissions from fossil fuels and not things like deforestation or agricultural emissions. And they certainly don't measure, as the International Government Panel on Climate Change does not measure, the methane emissions coming from the Arctic that we will discuss in this program. A new report released in late November by the United Nations Environment Program says the IPCC must report on melting permafrost and methane, including a special report if needed. Yet I've spoken by email with some IPCC reviewers who assure me the Arctic methane emergency is not included in the upcoming IPCC reports coming out in 2013 and 2014. Again, this intergovernmental agency is not just way beyond the actual science, but it's late on climate change as we know to be happening already.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Let us hear what the Arctic Methane Emergency Group has to say in their new film, Arctic Methane, Why the Sea Ice Matters. This compilation of experts includes Dr. Peter Wadhams of Cambridge University, NASA scientist James Hansen, Natalia Shakova from the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska, and David Wasdell, founder of the Apollo Gaia Project. The short film was put together by Nick Breeze and Brew Pierce of the new climate communication group called Envisionation. We start with Peter Wadhams, who has been measuring and exploring Arctic ice for decades. He is president of the International Association for the Physical Sciences of the Ocean Commission on Sea Ice, and he heads up the Polar Ocean Physics Group at Cambridge University in England.
Well, there's something happening now that really hasn't happened before, and it is very important and quite urgent that we recognise what's going on. That is that the ice has been getting thinner as over the last 40 years since I've been measuring it, and it's now lost about half of its thickness. So the average thickness of ice in the Arctic now is about half what it was 30 years ago. Big change. And so far it hasn't shown itself in a collapse of the ice cover, but it will very soon, because you can't keep thinning something off for a long time without it in the end collapsing. What's been happening is that the ice cover's been shrinking slowly, a few percent per decade, and so the whole Arctic Ocean is covered with ice in the winter. Then in the summer it shrinks back a little bit, and if you're lucky you can sail around the Northwest Passage or the Northern Sea Route, but just via some narrow slot. But then about 5 years ago the shrinkage started to accelerate, and now in the summer we have a huge area of open water in the middle of the Arctic, enough that you can see it on a satellite picture and the Earth looks blue at the top end instead of white. And that shrinkage is because the thinning of the ice is causing it to break up more readily in the summer. And in fact, what's happening now is that the melt in the summer is greater than the growth in the winter. So all the ice that grows during the winter will melt the following summer. So you will have a summer Arctic which is actually ice-free. And this will come about very soon at the rate we're going. If you extrapolate what's going on now for thickness, it'll bring us to an ice-free summer Arctic in about 4 years' time. So already we should be seeing something drastic happening probably this summer.
Now we go to Dr. James Hansen, director of the Goddard Space Institute for Space Studies, NASA.
Well, the Arctic is warming faster than most places on the planet. And that's partly because of the sea ice, because as we begin to lose some of the sea ice, it exposes the darker ocean, which absorbs more sunlight, and it causes the ocean to warm further and melt more ice. There are potential irreversible effects of melting the sea ice. If it begins to allow the Arctic Ocean to warm up and warm the ocean floor, then we'll begin to release methane hydrates. And if we let that happen, that's a potential tipping point that we don't want to pass.
David Wasdell, founder of the Apollo Gaia Project.
Well, it's in many places, but frozen methane is what we call clathrates or hydrates, which is a form of methane gas interlaced with water molecules in a certain sludgy form of ice. It's been formed by biological processes over many millions of years, and it's stored in the ocean sediment, the bottom particularly of the shallow oceans, north of the European continent and the North American continent, so the Canadian continental shelf and the Siberian continental shelf. Very rich deposits of methane held in the sedimental areas. But remember, those areas have been subject to ice ages, and we have fossil ice in the seabed left over from the ice ages, which has masked great deposits of methane underneath that frozen layer, as well as more recent methane in clathrate form above the fossil ice. So it's a big store, about three times, we think, the amount of hydrocarbons stored in the methane deposits, both in the shallow seas and also to some extent in the tundra on land, than the totality of oil, coal and gas deposits on the planet. Huge amount.
Natalia Shakova from the International Arctic Research Center.
So I would say that we started investigation, the methane issue in the Arctic in 90s of the last century. And we started from the terrestrial ecosystem, freshwater ecosystem, and then about 8 years ago switched to studying the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. And actually we've been studying it for the last 8 years, continuously, year by year by year, conducting one or two expeditions a year. And if, for example, a few years ago we could reach the certain sites from the fast ice. Fast ice is annual ice, and we can reach quite easily to certain sites, hundreds or tens of kilometers from the coast. But last 2 years we couldn't do that because the ice was broken. It was polynyas, it was brines, it was leads. So that means that, and where the sea ice should be about 2 meters thick, it was 40 centimeters thick. That means that the processes, they serve destabilization of everything, of the sea ice, of the water column, of the currents increasing, the movement of water beneath the sea ice increased. So everything looks anomalous.
James Hansen?
Well, there are now observations that methane is beginning to be released by both melting tundra on the land and bubbling up in the Arctic Ocean, indicating some warming of the Arctic Ocean.
Here is Peter Wadhams again.
One of the big effects is already happening, and I think the most important effect is the fact that with the sea ice already retreating in the summer, this slot of open water has become a very large expanse, and that open water absorbs so much radiation during the summer months that it warms up. So instead of sitting there at the freezing point like it used to do, it now warms up to about 5 degrees, and 5 degrees is very warm by Arctic standards, and that amount of heat in the water is enough to start warming up the seabed, because the retreat is happening over the continental shelves where the water's shallow. And so the seabed's warming up, and the seabed at the moment is frozen. It's offshore permafrost, an extension of the permafrost on land out under the sea. But when you're warming that up to 5 degrees every summer, it's now starting to melt and the permafrost is disappearing. And what that's doing is allowing a lot of methane, which is trapped under the permafrost, to be released. It's trapped as methane hydrates at the moment. But as soon as you melt the permafrost, it turns back into methane and bubbles up. So for the last 2 or 3 years, there's been a joint Russian-Alaskan expedition going out into the Siberian Sea and observing this. And they've been seeing great plumes of methane bubbling up all over the East Siberian Sea. The whole zone of millions of square miles of territory is now releasing all of its methane cover. And that's a large boost to global warming, because methane is an extremely powerful climatically active gas. It's about 23 times as powerful as carbon dioxide per molecule.
And David Wasdell.
I think the relationship between the behaviour of sea ice and the behaviour of the release of methane in the Arctic is very important. As temperature goes up, and it has reached an increase of about 3 degrees already over the pre-industrial temperature in the Arctic, it's warming faster than any other place on the planet, lots of things start happening together, and it's the combination of these processes that is so important to grasp. Not only do you have less sea ice near to the coast, so the coastal waters are warming, but you have warming of the tundra, thawing of the tundra, the permafrost areas on the continental, near coastal area. So the water running off from that comes in as warm, fresh water. So that warms the shallow seas over the continental shelf and pushes the sea ice further back. That means that that whole area of the ocean is now open to wave energy, storm energy, tidal energy, mixing down. So that the warm water from the surface is now being mixed down to those areas that it never reached while the whole area was covered in sea ice. So as soon as the area is open water, you have a process of heating that goes right down to those clathrate deposits on the seabed. They will then, instead of just releasing slowly and getting absorbed under the ice, start bubbling up through the surface of the water into the atmosphere. And the more the methane is released into the atmosphere, because it's a greenhouse gas, the more energy is retained from the solar input, and the faster the heating goes, which increases the rate of ice movement, decreases the area of the snowfields, increases the heat of the runoff, increases the heating in the ocean, increases the rate of methane, which increases the warming, which increases the rate of methane, and you have this feedback process setting off.
You are listening to a Radio EcoShock adaptation from the short film Arctic Methane, Why the Sea Ice Matters, prepared for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group in late 2012 by Invisia Nation. The next speaker is Natalia Shakova from the University of Alaska.
This particular sediment layer, which is 53 meters, doesn't seal this methane escaping from the seabed deposits any longer. It provides us with gas migration pathways. This is what is the significance of this.
David Wasdell from the Apollo Gaia Project.
I think we're all used to feedback systems in many processes of life. I'm sure you've been in a public hall with a public address system running and somebody on the sound system has turned the amplifier up too much and the output from the loudspeakers goes into the microphone and you get into a howl and everybody goes, oh, turn that off. Well, that's where feedback gets into the system and increases the signal. Lots of things in the climate that we have on Earth do that. Now, the distinction between just a feedback process and a runaway feedback process is very, very important indeed. You can have feedback that slowly increases, if you like, the risk and puts the temperature up a bit higher. Runaway feedback says the system responds so much to increased in temperature that it becomes faster in the way it changes the climate with rising temperature. So the hotter it gets, the faster it gets hotter. And the hotter it gets, the faster it gets hotter faster. Until you move into a process that is completely uncontrollable. And instead of coming up to a new equilibrium temperature, maybe a bit high, it goes on going up faster and faster until something runs out. There's no more methane to release, or we've run out of forests to burn or something, or there's no more ice to melt, and so that there's no more reflection feedback going on. The danger of moving into a runaway climate change scenario is now clear and is beginning to be quantified for the first time in the last few months. It's probably the greatest threat that we face as a planet.
Natalia Shakova.
So the methane in the atmosphere, the total amount of methane in the atmosphere, in the current atmosphere, it's about 5 gigatons. The amount of carbon preserved in form of methane in the Siberian Arctic Shelf is approximately from hundreds to thousands of gigatons. And of course, it's only 1% of that amount is required to double the atmospheric burden of methane. But to destabilize 1% of this carbon pool, I think it's not much effort needed, considering that the state of permafrost and the amount of methane currently involved. Because what divides this methane from the atmosphere is a very shallow water column and a weakening permafrost, which is losing its ability to seal, to serve as a seal. Just because this area is very seismically and tectonically active, and there was some investigation that the tectonic activity is increasing. And the seismic activity is, what is seismic activity? It's destabilization of these grounds. It's just mechanical forcing destabilization. So it's additional pathways for this methane to be escaped. We do not like what we see there. Absolutely do not like.
Peter Wadhams from Cambridge.
The other thing, of course, is climatic instability, that with an open Arctic you're going to have many more events like just we've had in the last few weeks of outbreaks of cold air in places you don't expect, large instabilities in the atmosphere, and which will affect agricultural production. So we think, you sort of think you're going to gain from global warming in that it gets warmer, you can grow more crops, you can grow crops further north in Canada and Siberia, and that's true. But also the instability means that at critical times those crops are going to be affected by frost or floods or rain. And the estimates are that actually you won't gain much from the warming in the northern hemisphere, and you lose a lot, of course, from the warming in all the tropical regions, which is really going to have a very serious effect on agricultural production. So the global warming impact on agriculture is going to be very serious, and it's going to be difficult to see how to support even the present world population.
James Hansen?
I think that the concept of adapting to the climate change is really a dangerous one, because there is the potential for climate effects which humanity practically cannot adapt to. If the ice sheets become unstable and sea level goes up multi-meters and eventually tens of meters, well, you're going to put all of the cities on coasts all around the world underwater, and you will destroy all of that heritage. So we don't want that to happen. That's the economic consequences of that are so enormous. It makes no sense to talk about adaptation to that. And likewise, if we burn all the fossil fuels, then we certainly will cause the methane hydrates eventually to come out and cause several degrees more warming. And it's not clear that civilization could survive that extreme climate change.
David Wasdell.
The rate of change that we're generating in the current situation is between 200 and 300 times faster than that experienced in any of the extinction events apart from the asteroidal impact. If you look at the general background change, for instance, it takes about 10,000 years to change the concentration of carbon dioxide by about 100 parts per million. We're doing it in 30 years at this year's rate. So the rate of change in the climate is phenomenal compared to previous extinction events. We are already in a mass extinction event. It isn't something that's going to happen in the future. We are now losing species and losing populations, partly by climate change, partly by habitat change, and partly by over-exploitation of habitats and fisheries, for instance. We've lost about 40% of the phytoplankton in the ocean, which is the base of the food chain, simply because of acidification and temperature change in the climate. This is already a mass extinction event. The question is, how far is it going to go? How serious does it become? And if we are not able to stop the rate of increase of temperature itself and to get that back under control, then a high temperature event, perhaps another 5 or 6 degrees, would obliterate at least as many as 60% to 70% to 80% of the populations and the species of the rest of life on Earth.
And finally, Peter Waters.
Whatever you do as an individual in your personal life is tiny, although it adds up if everybody does it, but what you can do to, say, influence politicians is maybe more important. So your role as a citizen, concerned citizen, is the most important role I think a normal person can adopt.
That was a Radio EcoShock adaptation from the short film Arctic Methane, Why the Sea Ice Matters. It was prepared for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group in late 2012 by Envisionation. Find links to all this in my blog at ecoshock.info, or check out the Emergency Group website at www.meg.me. That's meg.me.
Radio EcoShock.
Now we are warmed up, not too much yet, I hope. It's time for our feature interview. I'm going to call up Paul Beckwith, a man trained in both engineering and physics, but now devoting himself to the challenge of climate change and climate science. I reached him at the University of Ottawa. Could Earth's temperature really go up 6 degrees centigrade in just one decade? Our guest is Paul Beckwith, an undergraduate climate scientist from the University of Ottawa. He says this climate nightmare could happen. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, good. I'd first like to ask you, you have a background in engineering and physics. Why did you choose to study our climate?
Well, I've always been sort of interested informally in following climate and meteorology over the years. You know, I did the engineering degree many years ago in engineering physics. Then I stayed in school and did a master's degree in laser physics and then worked many years in that field. But like I say, you know, I've been sort of keeping an eye on what's going on with the climate. You know, in the last number of years, I've been very concerned about the rapidity of the changes. So I thought I might as well formalize my learning in the area and go back to graduate school and get the PhD in the area.
Well, we're all really concerned about that. But before we get to talking about that, I also read a blog post by you in which you described some of the basic physics of the way our planet works as far as temperature goes. And I think a lot of our listeners may not realize as the poles are warming, that changes the dynamics of things. I mean, we count on having cold poles and a hot center, but what happens when that changes?
Well, very interesting question. I mean, a lot of people have the misconception that the Arctic can be treated separately sort of from the rest of the climate. And, you know, as the Arctic's warming, it's the polar bears and the people living up in that region that, you know, are most at risk for changes. But what actually happens is the temperature gradient between the equator, which is generally fairly warm and unvarying in temperature, I mean, places on the equator have a temperature change of maybe 3 degrees mean annual temperature throughout the year, because they always get the 12 hours of sunlight year-round. They don't have this seasonal change in hours of daylight. So in the Arctic in particular, in the summer, the Arctic's warmer and the temperature gradient between the equator and the pole is smaller, so the jet streams, there's not as much cold air, so the jet streams are kind of confined closer up into the Arctic. They basically separate the cold air from the warm air. In the winter, you know, as the sun moves south and the poles, you know, naturally cool from the seasonal effect, that increases the temperature gradient. And basically, the winds that flow around the Earth in the jet streams increase significantly when there's a larger temperature gradient. Because when there's a temperature gradient, that creates a pressure gradient. And it's the pressure gradient that drives the winds. And the winds move from west to east because of the rotation of the Earth, giving rise to the Coriolis force, which basically deflects things to the right in the northern hemisphere. So as you mess around, as you change the temperature difference, you change the speed of the jet streams, basically. So these jet streams move to different locations. They become much wavier as the Arctic is warming, and they basically drive storm systems on the planet. So they drive the weather systems on the planet.
I get the idea that if we change the differentiation between the poles and the warmer center, then we are going to change the weather for the whole planet. Is that what we're getting to?
Yes. I mean, mostly for the northern hemisphere, because the southern hemisphere is a bit different. I mean, what we're doing is, well, with higher levels of greenhouse gas, the CO2 molecule, you have more of them in the atmosphere, and it absorbs the long-wave radiation. It absorbs the heat that's coming up from the Earth's surface. There's always a strong temperature gradient between the equator and the pole, but as the planet warms, the poles are warming at a much faster rate because there's a lot of reflective material up in the Arctic. Like the sea ice cover is typically, with a bit of snow on top, it's very white. It reflects about 90% of the incoming light from the sun. Same with the snow cover in the winter on the ground reflects a lot of the sunlight. So with the warming from the greenhouse gases, that's melting the sea ice. It's also melting the snow. So the snow cover is actually decreasing at an amazingly fast rate. It's about 17 or 18% per decade reduction in area for about the last 3 decades. And the sea ice is also exhibiting, you know, a rapid decline. So when you get rid of sea ice, you have dark ocean. When you get rid of snow cover, you have dark permafrost and dark ground. So the amount of absorption of energy from the sun is much, much greater. So the high Arctic is warming, you know, 5-6 times the rate that the average temperature is rising on the whole planet. So because of that albedo effect, the albedo is basically collapsing in the Arctic. It's basically dropping significantly, causing the Arctic to warm that much greater. And then that ties into the jet streams, as I mentioned. So it makes them wavier, and it slows them down. So they then become sort of stuck to certain persistent positions depending on the ocean-land contrast, and they get locked into position. So, for example, a couple of years ago, they were locked. So the trough of the wave, this enormous wave, was over Pakistan, and the crest, the peak of the wave, was over Russia, and it didn't move for 35 days. So the net result is in the trough, there's low pressure, there's lots of rain. So Pakistan was basically flooded out, three-quarters of Pakistan back then. And Moscow was under the high pressure of the ridge. It had a heat wave. It was over 30 degrees for 35 days. I think it killed about 50,000 extra Russians over the normal mortality rate. And they lost 40% of their grain crop, their wheat crop. So they didn't export that year. You know, they kept what grain they did produce up there. And also, it really dried out the areas over Moscow with the high pressure area, no rain, very arid, soils dried out, and there were forest fires galore. So we've been seeing this stuck pattern over the U.S. this last year. We've seen this high pressure ridge stay over, the farming belt areas in the U.S. Southwest. So basically, you know, we've had this persistent drought going. So as the sea ice declines, you know, much like in the next few years, as it declines more and more, it's very possible that these conditions will be persistent conditions. They'll be the new sort of conditions. And that's the worrying thing, because the food supply is probably the Earth system that is most liable to be affected by the rapid, abrupt changes that we're seeing in the climate. I mean, that's the worrying thing for humans.
Right. And what you've just described is what Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers has also described that we've been seeing. And I questioned her. I said, well, what do you think about this as a theory? She said, well, this isn't a theory. This is a series of observations, and that's what we published. Well, I'd like to get to this question of a possible tipping point or a sudden shift. Yes?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention with Dr. Francis that she's been working with the jets sort of for years. She published her paper in March. I mean, I've been talking about the jets and the interactions with climate probably for, you know, about the last year and a half. It's just that I haven't talked to her, but I've had emails with her and stuff, but also with Kevin Trenberth. And I talked to him just about a week ago about this, because he talked about extreme weather, but he never mentioned sea ice and being interacting with the jets. I asked him that question, and he said, well, you know, Francis's work is showing that both the sea ice is going and the jets are changing, he said, but it didn't indicate causality. I said to him, the causality is basic physics, and this is becoming very multidisciplinary. So my engineering view on systems and my understanding of physics is indicating to me that there is a direct causality, but it's not being recognized by some of the biggest names in climatology. So I'm going to work on putting together some papers for the literature to show those direct linkages.
Well, we need that, and I'm looking forward to it. Let's get to this idea of a sudden shift or a fairly rapid shift. Now, a couple of years ago, I interviewed a top American scientist, Dr. Michael McCracken, about a compilation of papers published in a book called Sudden and Disruptive Climate Change that was published by EarthScan. The authors took the subject quite seriously, as you do, but I came away with the impression that the best-known rapid changes they could find were cooling events rather than warming. Do we have records of rapid warming in the past?
Yes. Mike McCracken, I know him. I'm on emails with him quite frequently through this group called AMEG, which is Arctic Methane Emergency Group. So we do correspond quite a bit. So in terms of the rapid event, it's very important to try to get a handle on how quickly things are going to change. Because if you look at sea ice in the Arctic, if you look at the area decline of sea ice, and the modeling, the computer models that try to project, you know, what's going to happen in the future, most of the models are showing that it will maybe disappear by about 2040 to 2070, that sort of time range. I mean, that's the widespread view of, like, the British meteorological people, mainstream modelers. But if you look at the volume of the sea ice, it's declining much more quickly. And in fact, we lost about 20% of what was left in 2007, the previous minimum, in the space of about a week, you know, in early August as the cyclone went through. And it ended up much, much lower, 18-20% lower at the end of the melt season. And the models that, you know, if you just do a simple extrapolation fit to the data of volume, it looks like there's about a 50% probability that the ice is gone in September, the end of the melt season, in about 2015, you know, with maybe a 5-10% chance of it happening even next year. So it's going very quickly. So where is this going to take us? How quickly can the climate system of the Earth switch? As you say, there's something called the Dansgaard-Oscher oscillations, and these are typically when the Earth is much, much cooler. There has been spikes in the temperature of the 6 to 8 degrees, and it happens over, you know, in a decade or two. I mean, you can't really resolve down to the fine detail and see whether it's actually shorter than that, but that's sort of the maximum limit. You know, when the temperature has jumped up 6 to 8 degrees and then stayed there for a while and then it's declined back down 6 to 8 degrees. But most of the data is, as you say, it's when the Earth is much colder and, you know, it's about 5 degrees or so colder than it is today. It's in sort of in the cold period of the ice age cycles, which is being dictated by orbital cycles for the most part, you know, and then with feedback thrown in. You know, Wally Brokaw has a very good book. It's called The Great Ocean Conveyor, Discovering the Trigger for Abrupt Climate Change. So he was one of the big name climatologists who, you know, examined this idea that when we were coming out of the last ice age, there were these large pools of fresh water trapped over the land and by these ice dams. And when these dams gave way, you'd get an outpouring of fresh water into the Arctic. And that basically disrupted the thermohaline circulation and shut down the Gulf Stream. So that plunged the region up there into a, you know, a cooling period, which lasted for, you know, basically a couple thousand years until the ocean currents restarted and the period warmed up again. So this was a case where the north would get very, very cold and then it would get very, very warm. But there are periods in Earth's history where there's been large amounts of methane. I mean, methane is really the key. It's sort of the key. We have to get a better handle on methane. Like, we have to get better measurement because it's very, very sort of amazing how quickly it's starting to rise in the Arctic. I mean, the Russians went off the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, and they measured plumes of methane tens of meters in diameters a few years ago. About a year ago, they went back, and these plumes were up to 1.5 kilometers in diameter. So they'd grown from tens of meters to kilometers in diameter. There were a significant number, and it was thought that methane over that ice shelf would stay trapped in the marine sediments, but the water temperature is about 50 meters deep over those shells, and the water temperature has risen significantly, like 3, 4, 5 degrees, you know, in the last several years, and it's perforating through the seafloor, releasing that methane. There's also been methane releases recorded off Svalbard, and that's deeper, much deeper water. And in fact, I saw a paper just, you know, in the last couple, well, a couple papers in the last couple of months. One of them was talking about the methane emissions from the coastlines because, you know, methane's also coming up from the terrestrial tundra and permafrost as it's warming, but it's also coming up in larger amounts from coastlines because as the ocean is opened up, you get more cyclones, more, you know, like the one that happened in early August of this year. You know, very unusual, very strong cyclone covered most of the Arctic, sucked up warm air from Siberia, warm air with smoke from many forest fires. It was 20 degrees Celsius over Siberia, and it basically churned up the ice in the Arctic. Because it's a very low-pressure area, the cyclone, it raises up the sea level about a foot, basically over most of the Arctic Ocean, which then drew in warm water from the Pacific through the Bering Strait, plus Atlantic waters. That contributes to the melt. And it actually brought water up from about 500 meters deep, which is warmer water. So all of these things contributed to the melting. So the methane's definitely on the rise up there. Also, the Gulf Stream actually shifted a bit over to the eastern coast of the U.S., and it was warming the seafloor off the eastern U.S. So, I mean, it moved to where it wasn't going before, and people were actually measuring methane rising off the eastern seaboard of the U.S. as well. Now, people that measure it in the Arctic, it's measured by satellites. There's one called AIRS. You can Google it, A-I-R-S, and there's another one. I also got some data from Yurgumov, a Russian, and he presented a couple papers at AGU just last week, the big conference, detailing the methane rises. And it's also measured in flasks, just, measurements at ground level from sites up there. And both measurements at Svalbard and Barlow, Alaska, are showing very elevated levels, like levels of methane up to 2,100, 2,200 parts per billion I've seen. About the global concentration's about 1750 right now. So this is a significant increase. And if you look at the global increase of methane, it kind of was kind of stable until about 2007. But there's been a, relatively sharp and well-defined uptick since that time. So, that's the concern, because there's a misconception about methane. People say that the global warming potential of methane is about 21 or 25 times. That's correct, but that's averaged over 100 years. I mean, methane has a lifetime typically of about 12 years. So, on a short time scale of a year or two, the global warming potential of methane is about 150 times higher than CO2. So one molecule of methane can cause that, 150 times more warming than one molecule of CO2. So because it's concentrated, the source is the Arctic, and it's concentrated and localized, it's a definite heating source there. The meteorology of the Arctic is very bizarre right now. In fact, before you called, I was just generating some movies of, what it's doing in the long-range forecasts. And there's ridging. I mean, there's not much cold air up there. The pattern is not regular like it used to be. There used to be a strong polar vortex that sort of confined it, mostly west to east winds. But the winds are very wavy. The Rossby waves are, extremely wavy, and they rotate around and they slice through. And when the trough slices through where you're living, like in Ottawa, for example, it's like minus 10 degrees now. When the ridge was slicing through Ottawa last week, it reached about 18 degrees Celsius in Ottawa just last week. I wore shorts last week, and I as I look on the pattern changing, this is going to be what's happening. You get the ridge and you get the trough, and you get really warm, really cold. Normally we expect that as you go north, it gets colder. As you go south, it gets warmer. But what's happening is, if you're under the jet stream, it's warmer. You're getting air from south. If you're above it, it's colder. You're getting air from the north. And because these things are so wavy and the amplitude of the waves can cross almost the whole continent, 1,500 kilometers or more, you get these bizarre changes, and they can be very rapid, because as the wave moves past you, you could have it great one day and super, warm one day, super cold the next day. So it's really bizarre, and I'm convinced that it's tied to sea ice. There's a lot of factors at play here. Like, the problem is that scientists are too compartmentalized. You got the permafrost guy, you got the Arctic sea ice guy, you got the guy looking at the greenhouse gas concentrations, and they're not all talking to each other, so they don't know what the other guy's doing. That's why the systems approach of the whole system, what it's doing, what is happening, how it's evolving, that's what I'm really looking at, and it's very frightening.
Well, now, not everybody agrees with you. You know that.
Of course.
I interviewed three scientists about the threat of Arctic methane not too long ago for Radio EcoShock, and Dr. Peter Wadhams was one of my guests, and he very cogently explained his worries about increasing emissions of this dangerous gas. But Dr. David Archer from the University of Chicago said the emissions are still very small, much less, for example, than those generated in the tropics by things like rice paddies. How do you respond to those kind of cautions?
This is a great day for me, because Peter Wadhams, I'm emailing and in constant contact with him. He's also a member of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. He's one of the UK's top sea ice guys. He's been in the submarines and measured thicknesses of ice and so on. He had a Scientific American article, and he's really pushing the idea, like myself, that we need to regionally cool the Arctic to keep the ice there and the methane in place. And then you have David Archer. He's very well known in climatology. He's written numerous books. I've read some of them. So, did you ask him, for example, about the recent Russian work with There's Yurgumov is one of the scientists.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. That's Natalie Shikova.
Yeah, she's the one. I mean, the Independent newspaper in the UK, they had reference to her work about a year ago because that was when they measured that these plumes had increased in size to a kilometer more in diameter over the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. And they measured the methane coming up and they mapped it and where it was coming up and so on. But it was the rate of change. You know, it was minimal 2 years previous, and then it became huge. If you look at the AERS data from the Arctic, you know, you can look at it every year over the last decade, and the map has just exploded in red, and red is the color of higher methane. You know, it's just exploded across the entire Arctic region just in the last year or two, and same with the other satellite data. So I would have to ask Archer, you know, have you seen all of this latest data? You know, what's even more absurd to me is that the IPCC, their next report, they've actually publicly stated that they're not going to be considering methane levels rising, you know, in the Arctic too much for their report. And the climate, all the model, they treat methane as like a constant. I mean, but perforation of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, the seafloor, the methane coming up, this was never even considered. Everybody thought that the methane would stay down in those sediments, that there was an impermeable barrier. And no, it's coming up. You know, it's hard for everybody to keep up with this stuff, right? So these guys are great guys, but if they don't have data from the last year or two, then they're not seeing what's going on.
Right. I think the IPCC is definitely always 5 years behind the curve. And if the climate can change in 5 years, as we're talking about right now, that's a big problem. Well, let's put this together, Paul Beckwith. Can you please describe a scenario where the Earth could warm 6 degrees centigrade within a decade?
Within a decade or two. Let's say that the volume data on sea ice is correct. The melt season is usually about mid-September. So say around mid-September, maybe beginning of September in 2015, the Arctic Ocean becomes totally clear of sea ice. Okay, effectively, maybe a little bit around shorelines and stuff, but it's gone. So then basically the forcings from the Arctic, all that open water, you know, the additional heat and so on, it adds extra energy to the atmosphere. So it takes a lot longer for the ice to freeze up because all that heat is now stored in the ocean. In fact, parts of the Arctic Ocean are completely open now in the Barents Sea this year. If it's gone completely in 2015, the PO mass models, they show that within about a year, so about 2016, 2017, the ice is gone for 3 months of the year in the Arctic. So say, you know, it might be gone July, August, September. Now, if you extrapolate the graphs that show how the ice is declining in each month of the year, it does decline. There's less of it even in the winter months. Every single month of the year has less of it. So if you do a bit of extrapolation and track down, these models seem to indicate that you can lose the ice year-round in the Arctic within about 10 years from where the model shows. And this model did not even account for cyclone activity, for upwelling of warmer water, for these massive cyclones that last for very long duration in the Arctic, raise the water level, suck in warm water. If there's no snow and ice in the Arctic year-round, like if there's no sea cover, no sea ice, then we're in a much warmer state. Like the methane comes up, everything, all the feedbacks kick in, and we've had a state in the Arctic. I mean, look in the paleo records. The Arctic was, the continents were basically where they were, but we still had the seasonality. But we had, you know, tropical forests in the Arctic. We had frogs and we had snakes and we had various creatures that would die if it went below 0 degrees. You know, so the mean annual temperatures year round were above freezing, and you know, we had quite a different state. Now you can imagine in that type of situation what the jet streams are going to do. I mean, the jet streams, as they become slower and wavier, you know, they start to break up. You get a much more sort of fractured type of system. I mean, there might be a very weak jet due to the humidity difference between the equator and the Arctic. That may give rise. That's still going to be there, you know, when there's no ice at all in the Arctic. But so that might give some organization to the system. But, and these changes can happen. happen this fast. So it's I think people better, you know, need to start waking up to the reality of what's going on. You know, I've just generated all these movies of the Arctic, what it's doing like now with the, and you know, the changes are remarkable. There's very little cold air up there. Very little cold air. I mean, the changes right now, you know, every time I see these changes, they support sort of some of the views that I have that this system can change extremely rapidly.
If that happened, would it be too late to do anything about it?
Okay, so this is the key question. So we have a couple choices. We can do nothing, right? We can slowly ramp up renewables, slowly try to get a sort of some control of these escalating emissions. You know, lose the sea ice, see this rapid shift to a much warmer world, you know, with a lot of instability, a lot of geopolitical risks, a lot of scrambling for resources, food shortages, huge spikes in prices. The UN is projecting global food shortages next year. I mean, you know, we start getting that sort of thing, then everybody will be alerted to climate change and what it can do and be screaming for people to do stuff. So the group I was talking about, Arctic Methane Emergency Group, you can Google it. We've been a group about a year and a couple months. It started with a conference in Britain. We say that it is absolutely vital, if we want to preserve a stable climate system, that we geoengineer and regionally cool the Arctic. There's still risks, right? Some people say, well, I mean, you are tinkering with things, but the risks of doing nothing seem to be much, much greater to us. So what would we do? I mean, you know, one of the ideas that would probably work the quickest and easiest would be to inject some sulfur up into the stratosphere in the Arctic regions. A couple aircraft could do that, and then that would basically simulate the effects of a volcano, right? A large volcano will inject ash and sulfur up into the stratosphere, and because you're above the weather, it doesn't rain up there. The sulfur stays up there for years, and you know, a big volcano can cool the planet half a degree or a degree for 2-3 years. So if you inject the aerosols up there and cool that region, then you can start restoring the sea ice, which will then start bringing stability back to the jet streams and the climate system. This is what our group has been pushing for. We have been making some headway with mainstream media, with more articles. We've got some very good scientists in our group, but there's a movie maker, there's a medical doctor who's retired, there's all these different people. There's, in fact, I just saw a couple articles with David Keith. I mean, he's one of the big geoengineering people from, I think, University of Calgary. And he's written a couple articles lending support to the idea that, yes, we could quickly put together technology to regionally cool the Arctic. But the political will and the bureaucracy and the thing, if we delay too long, if we let the Arctic, all the sea ice and the snow cover decline in the Arctic so that these positive feedbacks kick in, then we'll probably have lost that window to effectively, you know, restore a stable climate. There's a huge urgency to this because of the positive feedback. So this is what the AMEG group, which I've been a member of for a year, is trying to purport. And like, basically, we can regionally cool the Arctic. You know, we can physically do it.
Is there a website or a blog for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group?
Yes, I think it's just ameg.me or something, or if you just Google Arctic Methane Emergency Group, we have lots of documents, lots of stuff. Website's getting quite good.
And as we wrap up, Paul Beckwith, is there anything you'd like to add?
The key is the public is starting to wake up to the recognizing that something's not right. Like just winter's not like it used to be. Summer's not like it used to be. You know, extremes of weather. There's more hurricanes. There's more tornadoes. There's derechos crossing the country, straight line winds. There's haboobs, which is dust storms. There's, you know, massive droughts. If the drought continues, the Mississippi could drop enough that the barges can't go, and that's a huge economic penalty just from that. You know, the UN's talking about food. I mean, listen to what the scientists are saying. Start taking political action. Write letters, demand that things be done, right? I mean, I don't think anything's going to happen personally until people start paying double for food or something in a year. You know, we just need one, you know, if this drought continues, imagine this drought continuing for 10 years, this big, huge drought in the U.S., 10 years, 15 years. You know, how is society going to adapt to this? We've got to start thinking about all these things, and very quickly.
Our guest has been Paul H. Beckwith, who is moving from his background in engineering and physics to study climate change as a priority at the University of Ottawa. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome.
We're out of time. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Be sure and visit our website at ecoshock.org to download all our past programs. Please make a donation if you can to keep the site full of free downloads for everyone. And find the links for this program in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for donating your attentive mind to our broadcast this week.